You're listening to the On Call Nightmares podcast, and every week I bring you conversations with technologists who spend some time on call. This week, I come to you from Stockholm, Sweden, where I am taking part in the Microsoft Ignite, the tour thing that we've been doing. I guess I'll just call it a thing. It's been really great. I got to meet a lot of people. I got to wear a Bathory stage while I did my, or I should say a Bathory t-shirt while I did my talk today. And that in itself was really great. So obviously I'm not in a normal space, so sound quality isn't quite as great as it normally is, so I do apologize for that. But let's get on with the normal things that I do, which is, one, if you'd like to be on the podcast, it's extremely easy. You can send me an email. It's oncallnightmares@gmail.com, or reach out to me on Twitter. It's @oncallnightmares, or I should say @oncallnightmare, no S. Sorry, Twitter didn't give me enough characters for that S. Or you can just reach out to me personally at Jay Destro. So this week, I spoke to the person who gets woken up for you to get woken up. And that would be Arup Chakrabarty of PagerDuty. Arup has been working in the space of software since about 2007. The guy went to Harvard Medical School and then made a decision to become involved in systems and software development operations. And that alone is really amazing. Just hearing his insight into things was pretty cool. So let's move on to the podcast for this week. Let's hear with our conversation with Arup, and hopefully you enjoy it. And you learn as much as I did. So let's get into it, okay? So once again, you are listening to the On Call Nightmares podcast. And every week I bring you conversations with technologists who spent time on call. So I know I've brought along some heavy hitters in the past. And this time I wanted to go almost Inception-like. I wanted to find out who wakes up the people who wake us up. And by doing that, I've been lucky enough to have a conversation today with Arup Chakrabarty of PagerDuty. He is the director of engineering. He's been doing a lot since, what, around 2007?
Yep.
You're talking about operations engineering at Amazon. You helped with the Amazon Marketplace and actually leading teams, as well as teams over at Netflix to improve availability and reliability. But right now, you're helping with infrastructure as a director of engineering over at PagerDuty. So, hello, Arup. Thank you very much for your time today.
Oh, thank you for having me, Jay. Appreciate it.
Awesome. So I'm going to let you take a quick victory lap, and then I want to get into finding out more about you. But I wanted to congratulate PagerDuty. You all just went public, like, what, a week ago? Yeah. And I can say you've got a product that I know I've been – it's been a part of my career and a lot of other people who probably listen to this podcast career. Was it really cool to just finally cross that line?
Yeah, you know, it was – you know, one of the things about going public that, you know, our CEO, Jen, was talking about, it's kind of like a marriage, and that, yes, it's a big, exciting day, and you prep for it for weeks, months, and years, and then it happens, and then the hard part's actually staying married. And so now that we're past it, it was a fantastic celebration. It's a great recognition from not just, you know, the public markets itself, but really, you know, the only way we got here was actually practitioners like yourself and the rest of our customers. So we're incredibly honored and humbled by this kind of recognition. But for us, this is just another milestone, and we got to keep working harder and harder to make our customers happier and happier.
Yeah, I think that you all reaching that public level says to everyone that actually the work that they're doing by utilizing your product is also successful. Yeah. So people who are putting together rotations for whether it's IT teams or people who are part of other non-IT based, like I've heard of where people use PagerDuty for things like reminding their kids to have certain diabetes levels, whether or not they should take more insulin. Like I've heard about this, and I just think it's really amazing. And you've got some really great people there. My friend Matt is a great part of that team. So congratulations. But now it's time to start talking about the really cool stuff, I think.
aside from going public, and that's being on call. So you've been a technologist for a while. Let me hear a little bit about how you got started being in on-call resources in your career, I suppose.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the, you know, I'll kind of do a quick replay of my career. So I actually started out before I was officially in the software industry. I was actually doing a lot of medical research. So when I was during my undergraduate work, I studied bioengineering and actually had plans on going to medical school. And of course, what do doctors do? They go on call. You know, they have that was just part of their lifestyle. And so when I was working in medical research, there was actually times where, you know, we were doing research on things like cadavers and whatnot, and you have very short time span when, like, you have, you know, the right kind of subject, the right kind of test, and everything set up. So we actually had the notion of on call in the research lab that I was working in. Of, hey, you know, a patient's come in with a very specific case that, you know, matches the research that we're trying to do. They're willing to be part of it. And so, yeah, there were times where it didn't matter wherever I was. If I got paged at Saturday night, that was my Saturday night, and I had to physically drive in to the hospital and take these things. But then even, you know, later as I entered the software industry, a lot of that kind of preparedness translated very cleanly into how we did incident management, incident response in my previous company. So, you know, like you said, I worked at Amazon for about 4 years and change. And there, you know, I had the opportunity to work with just some phenomenal engineering teams and some phenomenal engineers. And, you know, initially my role was acting as an operations support engineer, working with a lot of other engineering teams and helping them figure out, like, hey, what is the best way to go on call? How do we monitor and inspect our services? When something does break, how do we automate some of the fixes that we can, you know, preferably do instead of getting people woken up? And so, you know, at Amazon, I learned a lot more about, you know, what does it look like for, you know, not just individuals to go on call, but for teams, departments, companies to go on call. By the time I joined Amazon, they had gone through what I'd consider like their big DevOps transition. And so I was there towards kind of the tail end of it. And it was really interesting to see, like, wow, this actually does work at scale. Like the company had figured out a lot of interesting ways to, how do you orchestrate a response with 100 people at once effectively? And, you know, then I had the opportunity to then work at Netflix again with just phenomenal engineers, phenomenal teams. And, you know, Netflix was this was an interesting year of transition that I was there, where, you know, the company was heavily investing more and more in their streaming platform. And, you know, we forget sometimes, but Netflix used to ship DVDs by now. And that, and as the, you know, CEO of Netflix, Reed Hastings, would say, you know, they were trying to get the latency of video delivery down from 2 days to 200 milliseconds. And so that was, you know, what they were trying to do.
It was a huge kind of shift. And not to interrupt, but what I really appreciate about the time that you're at Amazon and then over into Netflix is the birth of AWS starting to happen around that.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's really when the cloud as an idea beyond just a simple storage becomes something where you start seeing compute jobs go into the cloud. And then eventually it becomes something that's part of an everyday business for people. So I know Netflix was one of the very first all-in, 100% all-in on AWS. Were you part of, like, some of those early, like, building reliability with tools over at that you learned from Amazon over at Netflix?
Yeah, so one of the team that I had the privilege of managing was the cloud operations and reliability engineering team at Netflix. And there was a fellow, Greg Orzel, that I had the chance to work with. So he is the father of Chaos Monkey. And so I had the chance to work with him directly. And the team that I worked on, the engineers on the team built out some other members of, you know, what's called the Simian Army. So things like Chaos Gorilla and Chaos Calm. One of the engineers, Corey Bertram, who's now one of the VPs of infrastructure over at Datadog, he had built out a lot of that tooling. And the team since, you know, I left Netflix after about a year, but the team has grown quite a bit, and they've published books on things like chaos engineering, all this amazing, amazing work. And so while,
you know, yeah, I was just going to say, between what Nora Jones had done, I've seen her do some really great talks when she was with Netflix, and what Colton from Gremlin has gone on to do as well. It's been really cool to see how an entire like practice of technology came out of a very, very small portion of an engineering department.
Yeah.
And that's amazing to me.
What's so interesting about that too, is like, if you're going back, like, you know, 10-ish years, again, as companies are, you know, when you think about the cloud, it was the scary thing, right? Mm-hmm. People were terrified of it. And Netflix had that pretty bold decision of like, nope, we're going to let AWS build data centers, not us. But what they did realize was, wait, we can't just forklift all of our processes, all of our deployment tools, everything that we did in our data center to AWS. We have to
fund it one-to-one.
Exactly. You can't just, you know, lift and shift these things. And that's where, you know, when things like Chaos Monkey was released, it was to really help engineers understand like, hey, this is a different way of working now. In fact, we're going to actively practice this stuff in production, because guess what? That's actually what reality is now. And, you know, the cool thing that, that I saw, at least at Netflix, was people really understood the importance of it, because one, I think they appreciated, instead of getting woken up at 3 a.m, you know, for Amazon deciding to kill their instance, it was at 2 p.m, and it was within their own control. Like, this was something that they didn't have to get interrupted in off hours to practice. And then the other piece was like, they saw themselves how, you know, again, early AWS technologies and early cloud technologies were unstable. Like they had mm-hmm. a lot of reliability challenges. And what I loved about the Netflix philosophy, which was, look, at the end of the day, the end customer doesn't give a crap about whether the instance died or why or who was responsible. All they care, they want to do something and they couldn't. And as a service provider, you have the responsibility to insulate your customers from these problems.
Yeah, the whole idea of 99.999% is okay, because you're never going to ever really notice that point that you're getting, that 100th percentile that you're going to miss. Yeah. It's so rare. And so I get, you know, I've heard a lot of people talk about, this is the way that you should look at monitoring in general nowadays, is that 100% uptime is no longer feasible, because everything's always breaking, and you should make the assumption that your solution is not at 100% at all times. And you should have the tooling and the wherewithal in your automation to know that something, when it dies, it's replaced and you can move on with your lives. And I think that's important for what we look at as modern operations. But yeah. So you spent time over at Netflix, then you spend a little bit of time at HeavyBit, and you do some program advisory, and then you come over to PagerDuty. Mm-hmm. So that's a probably taking some changes in what you were doing, but when you're back at PagerDuty, now you're working as an engineering manager, and you're part of this, you know, really growing product that I'm imagining you're throwing a lot of hardware, or like I should say, instances at, and things like that. So tell me a really ugly story from that time. But while you tell me that story, we got to go over the rules first. That's the way this podcast works. So don't incriminate yourself, because we don't need you to get in trouble. You work there now. You're not in trouble. Don't incriminate others, because as we say in the world of DevOps and SRE, blamelessness is the way we do retrospectives and help us learn, because this podcast is a learning experience for me, for everyone listening. So you're building out PagerDuty, and you yourself are on call, I would imagine, at some point.
Yep, it's still on.
So talk to me about a nasty incident and kind of how it impacted you, and also maybe how it impacted the business of PagerDuty.
Yeah, I'll share one that, you know, we've actually talked a little bit about publicly, so I don't, cool. I don't think I'll get myself into any, if I'm in trouble, I'm already in trouble at least there. So
let's go. Fair enough.
So this was a couple years back, but we had this really interesting bug with our NTP cluster. So like many companies, we have you know, data stores that rely on NTP. So we have to have some pretty resilient NTP network time protocol. We have to make sure our servers are on the same time. And mm-hmm. You know, we use a variety of database technologies, and one of them being Cassandra's, which again is one of the way Cassandra decides, like, you know, which write wins versus which read wins is based on time. So we have pretty pretty sharp tolerances that we want to maintain with our NTP clusters. And this was a couple of years ago. And one of my teams, our site reliability engineering team, because this NTP is a shared service, they actually run a set of servers that access the pool for all of our infrastructure. So all of a sudden we start seeing this, of course it's on a Friday night. It's always
DNS or it's always on Friday.
Exactly. And so, what starts happening is, you know, we have the SRE team starts getting some alerts based on, you know, NTP acting a little bit funny. Mm-hmm. And so they get alerted for it. And sure enough, now almost every other engineering team we have at the company is also getting alerted for it, because just weird things happen when time starts to drift on your servers. And so the SRE team, you know, they jump on it pretty quickly, and they realize, like, wait a second, this is pretty bad. Like, we don't know exactly what it is yet, but let's proactively get a hold of everyone. Now, of course, because this is PagerDuty, all of our engineering teams are on call, and because mm-hmm. they own their own data stores as well, they're already paged. So by the time we spun up a major incident response internally, everyone was already up and ready.
Getting alerts about database consistency. You're getting alerts about the alerts. You're getting alerts about the storage itself. Things sound scary.
Yeah, so this is where, like, basically every engineering team is getting alerted for this and trying to figure out what the hell is going on here. And thankfully, you know, the SRE jumps on the call. It's like, hey, like, folks, like, I know everyone just got woken up and everyone is probably panicking, thinking the whole thing is burning down. But thankfully, you know, the SRE on call is able to pinpoint it very quickly and say, no, it's due to NTP, but our runbook's not working right now. You know, basically we had a set of procedures that we would run and it simply wasn't working. And so, you know, basically we had there's a couple of tough decisions you make there where, in a good way, you know what the area of focus needs to be. Sure. And so, like, from a good standpoint, like, it's a bit of a relief where we're able to quickly realize, like, okay, the customer impact is actually very, very small. It's not like, you know, we're not like throwing 500s for all of our customers, but, you know, we know if we let it go on for too long, we might see some data consistency issues. We might see some issues with, you know, ordering of events for our customers might get out of whack. And so that's where we know it's something that, yeah, we can tolerate a little bit here and there, but then realize that we can't deal with it for too long. So the SRE team, they end up working the issue for a while. And, you know, unfortunately we had to make a tough decision where we told the engineering teams, look, you can't turn off your alerts or mute them for a couple hours, because if there's something more severe that happens in the meantime, we actually need to know about it, because that might actually change your focus. So, mm-hmm. you know, for example, like, if one of our systems all of a sudden starts to get really impacted by it, we might have to make that tough decision to say, nope, change the NTP pool, like, focus on a different pool instead and siphon off that service onto a different pool. Or it means we might need to take more drastic measures and say, you know what, reroll the entire NTP fleet. And yeah, it's going to be painful for 30 seconds, but as long as it drives that consistency that we need afterwards, great. Like, it's short-term pain for the long-term benefit. And so, you know, the SRE team, along with a handful of engineers who were constantly getting woken up, coming in and out of the call all night, they're working the issue, trying a couple of different things. And what ended up fixing the issue was actually, there was some cache that we had on the NTP servers that we had never even tried this before. And so we tried wiping this. So on the staging servers, we did it. We wiped this cache, and it seemed to fix the issue in staging. And we basically made that tough decision of, look, this is pretty risky because we don't actually know what the full impact is going to be in production. So we started small. We started with one of the servers, seemed to work. Okay, went through the whole pool, and then the following morning it was fixed. The big learning I had from that was incident response is a team sport. I think there's this weird, like, I think, myth that a lot of companies have, where like you have someone parked in the basement or wherever somewhere off on their own, fixing things furiously by themselves. And, you know, years of being on call, and I've had to be that person.
Yeah. I always like to call it the Brent of the Phoenix Project. Yeah. Like there's always the Brent in many companies. And I only say Brent because that's the character's name, but it's unfortunate that, you know, there's been a lot of places where on call drifts through one person.
Yeah. And it's, and you know, there's something that I'm just so proud of, you know, our engineers at PagerDuty, you know, it's not that we do take these things seriously, again, especially mm-hmm. when we know that it potentially has customer impact. But if you ever were to listen to one of our calls, you'll actually hear quite a bit of laughter. You'll actually mm-hmm. hear people on there cracking jokes. And again, not because we don't take this stuff seriously. Of course we do. But when you've been up all night and you're exhausted and you're like trying to figure something out, and when you're about to swap in with someone else, the one of the best ways to maintain morale, and honestly in my opinion focus, is to keep the mood light, is to make sure that you don't take yourself too seriously. Again, take the work seriously, take the customer impact seriously, don't take yourself seriously, and make sure you're building that, again, that team mindset, because that's what ultimately led to the resolution. Was basically, I don't know if it actually came from RS Reed team, the idea of like, hey, let's try this. That pretty sure that came from another team. And when you think about that kind of creative problem solving in the stressful environments, the last thing you want to do is to come into that environment and say like, hey, if you don't fix this within 10 minutes, like you're all fired. That's the worst thing you could do for creative problems.
And I think the way that you kind of describe how like that's come together now is that we've taken that idea that we heard about of DevOps years ago, and it sounds like you've got it put into practice, and that's exactly the way it's supposed to go. That multiple teams, when you know the shit hits the fan, are supposed to collaborate because of information sharing and shared responsibility of services and taking responsibilities for the things that you build. And it's really great to hear that put into practice was successful for you, even in what was a very difficult period.
Yeah, and look, it doesn't come for free, right? I think a lot of companies, like, you know, instead of time to resolve, they time to finger pointing, right?
Yeah.
It's time to have, you know, how quickly can I get the blame off of my team? Mm-hmm. And I understand why people, especially in management positions, think that, right? Because, you know, what's the usual course at most companies? It's something breaks, it gets fixed. And then you have some person and, you know, higher up that gets really upset, and customers, again, rightly so, are upset. And, you know, the manager of the team, or maybe even the tech lead of the team, gets dragged out in front of a bunch of folks, and they basically get the equivalent of tomatoes thrown at them for 45 minutes. That's what's called a postmortem meeting.
Yeah.
And it just, it breeds this, like, you know, very, in my opinion, dysfunctional relationship between teams and people.
Yeah. Credit driven management, to me, when I say credit, I mean like credits you have to return to customers and decisions that are made thereafter isn't a great way to deal with people. If you just had to give, you know, say $20,000 credit to a customer based on something that you as a business were not able to do, I don't believe that it's really, and maybe it's, you know, you went out of SLA based on something, who knows, and it costs money. But I don't see that blaming people individually and taking them in front of the rest of the business and trying to say, you know, we spent all this money and it's because of y'all. You know, I just don't find value in that. And I think the more I hear about blamelessness and the way that people handle postmortems, it sounds more like a way to keep a business moving forward, as opposed to eventually creating schisms based on just the fact that something went wrong and you lost a little money.
Yeah. And, you know, I absolutely agree with that. And I think the other interesting thing that I'll point out there, when you can have like a truly blameless postmortem, you create this really wonderful sense of self-accountability, where all of a sudden, you know, people will want to do better. Because if you connect, say, like, you know, my my favorite postmortems are the ones where, yeah, we acknowledge it was a very complicated incident. Here are some of the contributing factors that led up to it. Unfortunately, here is the customer impact. And what I found is when, like, you focus on those pieces more than, like, the people, like, you know, a root pushed this button and screwed everything up at this time. If you take the focus off of that and focus more, again, on those contributing factors and the customer impact, I've found engineers are able to rally around, like, well, here's what we can do to mitigate this issue in the future. And it becomes more about, like, the systems and the processes that need to
and
get.
That leads to collaboration
and
growth. Exactly. Yeah, so positive environment that's grown by management teams can eventually lead to a more positive, you know, environment that you can find that toil and start reducing it because of major incidents. You'll have an incident, and then by positively sharing the failure, if you will, you can give people ideas to repair and to prevent and to make things better. And I think that's the collaborative environment that many businesses are shooting for.
Yeah, it's hard though, because, you know, I have the luck that, like, you know, I've been at PageU since we were about, like, you know, 15, 20 people. And to our founders' credit, and honestly to our leadership's credit at the company, they've kind of really, I won't even say encouraged, almost like forced that kind of collaboration. And part of that is, again, like, we have that DevOps DNA woven into the fabric of our company, just by the nature of, like, who our customers are, who our early employees are, who our leadership and everything. And I totally understand that when you, let's say you're at a company that doesn't have that, it's so hard to weave that in there and to change the behaviors and the culture where people are collaborating on these very stressful situations.
Yes. So that leads me to want to ask some things to help us wrap up. One of the things I really wanted to ask you is if you as a manager of people, you have your direct reports and you're also on call. You as a manager who's on call, what advice would you give to other managers that are currently, you know, have teams of engineers that are on call? What advice could you give to them on handling that team?
Yeah, I think I'll start kind of high level and then get more specific and, like, tactics and stuff that you can do. I think the number one thing is to just have a lot of empathy and understand that, you know, on-call is hard. It is something that, yes, it is increasingly part of the job, but that doesn't mean that we should, like, expect people to go on-call for weeks, months at a time and accept that that's okay to interrupt their personal lives and interrupt every single facet of their life. Yes, again, I'm a huge advocate of engineers going on-call and owning their services, but I'm not an advocate for people staying up 24/7 for 30 days straight. That's terrifying, and that's terrible. And so, like, the number one thing I tell managers is have empathy for the people on your team, but also for yourself. Like, you know, in an interesting way, I've seen a lot of managers, again, with the best of intent, with trying to, like, shield the team from a lot of work, so they'll take extra on-call shifts off their engineers sometimes. Again, great intent, but that's not being empathetic to yourself. That's, you know, now you're just going to burn yourself out instead of your engineers, which is no good either. Again, another high level thing is, and I'll get into more specifics after that, is really understanding the metrics around on-call and understanding, like, you know, what is a reasonable load. And that's different depending on your team. If you have a team, let's say, of like 15 people that's able to do a 24/7 fall of the sun distributed across the entire world, the on-call load for that team is very different from a team of 5 people located in a single time zone that own a set of services. So, so you know, you have to play with the numbers. And I find, like, honestly, just talking to your engineers and asking them, like, hey, what's a reasonable load for on-call? Let's discuss that, can kind of help you get there. But if you can't come up with something, my like, you know, rule of thumb is if a team's getting paged more than 5 times a week, something's funny. It doesn't mean something's wrong, but something funny is going on that you want to spend some time on. And so more tactically, I think weekly on-call reviews are critical. Like, that weekly cadence, whether it's Monday afternoon, Friday afternoon, I don't care, but just that weekly cadence where the engineer brings up, like, hey, here's the number of times I got paged last week, and here's the, you know, 4 or 5 incidents that I had to cover. and they cover with the whole team. It's not just like the next on-call. That's really how you can enforce this culture of like giving a crap about on-call health and making sure that your systems are stable and everything. Because, you know, the other thing I always bring up to a lot of managers is when your engineer gets paged, like that's bad. Again, that in itself, if we just optimize solely for that, that'd be okay. But we also have to remember when an engineer gets paged, that means there was some customer impact. Mm-hmm. There was something that a customer, again, clicked a button and got a 500. They went to add an item to cart and couldn't do that. And now the business suffered as a result. And so in a really nice way, the interest of like your customers and your engineers and the manager are now all of a sudden aligned. Because you're reviewing those metrics, you're trying to reduce those number of instances, you're trying to fix those problems as best as you can, make sure that you're doing that weekly review. And then
have like a Prometheus for your people, if you will.
Yeah.
I mean, exactly. There's no other way to kind of put it, but like create some sort of way to monitor and have metrics for the people that are doing the on-call work, and then determine when you're max or you're past certain thresholds that you find to be acceptable.
Yeah, like one of the things that the SRE principles, especially from Google, that I really love is this idea of error budgets, right? That you don't set an SLO of 100%. You set it for, let's say, 99.95. Mm-hmm. That gives you a couple of minutes a year to do some maintenance. Or let's say you might have burned through it in January, so you have to be a little bit more careful with the next time you make a change. I'd like the idea of a similar idea for your people as well, where like you have a goal that you're trying to hit. Again, I can tell you right now, the right goal for number of times an engineer gets woken up, it's not zero. Like I wish it could be, but I can tell you right now, you're gonna have problems in your system where at least once a week, you know, someone is gonna get woken up, or preferably they just get interrupted during the day. But the right answer is never zero. And so with that, acknowledging that, like, yeah, there's going to be times where you are going to have to take some additional on-call load, but realizing that should always be temporary, though. That should only be something that you, when it does surface up, again, ideally during that weekly review, and it's hopefully something that you can fix that following week or, hell, even the same day, that sets the team up for what I think, like, is a sustainable on-call work-life balance, not just for that week, but, you know, for weeks and months to come, if you're able to get down that cadence down.
Gotcha. So definitely review what your people are doing. Keep an eye on the numbers. Make sure that you as the manager are following up on these things and adding or removing resources when they're needed based on what load is, kind of almost the way we look at how we look at services. So so you gave me one little like piece of advice earlier for people who are on call where you said keep it light. And to tack on to keep it light, how have you kept it light over the years? Is there any one little thing that you can say, I turn to this when the chips are down?
So, you know, I guess, so one, you know, one thing a lot of my teams always make fun of me about is, you know, I tend to be a pretty happy, optimistic person. And so for me, it's actually quite hard to get me down, and I will always find the silver lining in anything. And even in the middle of an incident, you know, I'll be able to find something where it's like, well, you know, at least the moon didn't hit the earth today. Like, you know, at least something, you know, like, at least something more catastrophic didn't happen.
Yeah, you know, at least Thanos ain't real.
Exactly. I think, you know, other tips for keeping it light, I think having that discipline and that trust with people, again, take the problem seriously, take the incident and your processes seriously, but don't take yourself seriously. And I think from a leadership standpoint, if you're not able to crack a joke here and there, and I'm serious, like in the middle of like, if there's a lull in your incident call as like, you know, you're waiting on something to restart, if you can't crack a joke there, guess what? Your engineers and the other people in your organization, they're not going to be going
stress.
To exactly. Yeah. They're not going to feel the, you know, almost that safe space to say those things. I think the, you know, other thing, way to keep it light is really this focusing on that culture of learning and understanding that yes, you are going to make mistakes, but the idea is that you don't make the same mistake twice. That's like, as a manager, that's when I get upset, right? It's not when one of my engineers and one of my managers makes a mistake, but we're going to make mistakes and we try to minimize the impact, of course, but I get upset when people don't learn from their own mistakes. And mm-hmm. really collaborative environment, what you start to see is you start to learn from others' mistakes. And that's when, like, when you talk about accelerated learning, oof, like, that's a fun place to be, where all of a sudden you're sharing your postmortems internally. So, like, at PagerDuty, we actually broadcast very internally. We're very open and transparent, where anyone can listen in on our incident calls. They can follow along with our scribe and everything. If someone from sales is curious, like, what's going on, they can see everything. And we do that on purpose. And, you know, while I've very occasionally had to ask people very politely to jump off of the call if they're being disrupted, it doesn't happen very often. And so, like, I think that's another way to encourage that kind of collaborative learning environment, is to just make it easy for people that if they're interested, they can follow along, set some expectations that, hey, don't be disruptive, let the people do their jobs. But, and then after that, you know, once the postmortem gets, you know, created and filed away, we also send that back out to everyone. So people who were thinking, like, oh, I wonder what happened from that incident 2 weeks ago, oh, here's the postmortem in my inbox now. And so again, it's with that intent of really over communicating and being transparent with, you know, with some of our learnings there.
Great. So I'm going to take us to the end of our interview. Thank you so much, Arup. This was a really great conversation. It gave us a little bit of insight into the world of who wakes up, the people who get woken up. But hopefully not too much, because, you know, as you said, it only should happen once in a while. It shouldn't happen too much.
We take our responsibilities and duties very seriously at the company.
Absolutely. So Arup Chok on Twitter is how people can find you. That is ARUPCHAK. Are there any other projects or anything else you'd like to share before we kind of say goodbye?
The last thing I'll kind of leave folks with is, you know, try your best to make on-call less scary for your engineers. That's something that, you know, again, it's different for every company, different for every team, different for every manager. And that's something that I see for a lot of our customers that they struggle with, where it's scary initially. But again, folks like yourself, Che, and folks like myself, we've been doing it for a long time, so it's less scary for us. And, you know, as much as we can for each other within the community, let's figure out how to make it less scary for each other.
That's why I'm capturing these stories, because I want to make sure that for the person, and, you know, I had someone recently who told me, you know, I'm just on call. I just got on call recently and I found your podcast and it's really helped me, just because I'm hearing stories of what other people are doing. And I really appreciate that, because as much as I like also hearing from the other, you know, 15, 20 year vet who's like, oh, wow, I really identified with that story. It's the person that hasn't been in those situations that's going to learn from you and people like Charity who've been on, and others who have good information on how to make this work feel a little better, come together a little bit. So like I said, thank you very much for your time today. You can, like I said, find Arup on Twitter. It's Arup Chok. Thank you very much. We'll talk to you hopefully someday soon. Thank you for your time.
Absolutely, Jay. It was absolutely my pleasure.
Really appreciate it. All right, we'll be right back and wrap up the rest of the podcast.
Thank you very much, Arup. That was a great conversation we were able to have, and I really do appreciate your time. PagerDuty has been one of those really, really important tools for so many people, and what his team seems to be doing is just tremendous. So I want to thank him a lot for his time, and everybody over at PagerDuty, including my buddy Matt. You're all doing great work. Thank you so much for helping us, but no thanks for the wake-up calls. My wife is still disappointed with all of you, but that's not your fault. Anyhow, I want to say thanks a lot for listening. It's been, what, over 20-something episodes now, and I'm really proud that we've been able to kind of have these conversations with together, me and you and our friends that we've had on the podcast. So, you know, if you would like to be on, please reach out. I'd really love to talk with you. So we'll see you next time as I have another conversation with a technologist who spent some time on call. See you later.